Hey, Rex, are you there?
I'm here.
Describe your location. Set the scene for us.
Oh, I'm in a cornfield south of Buckland, Kansas, probably 5 or 6 miles. I can see the elevator pretty clearly from here. I'm sitting next to an irrigation well that's next to a center pivot system. A little bit of snow on the ground, but not too much. It's drifted in places. But the sky is blue and the sun's out. It's not a bad day out here.
Is it muddy?
No, it's been so cold out here that the ground is frozen, which for what we're doing is a good thing, because what you want to be able to do is drive right up to these wells. You don't want to walk if you can absolutely avoid it. So when the ground's frozen hard, you don't have to worry about getting stuck unless you hit some snow. So with the ground frozen hard, you can drive right up to the place you want to get to.
What are you doing there?
I asked myself that Saturday and Sunday when the wind was blowing about 45 miles an hour and it was snowing, and I was trying to figure out if I could get through a snowdrift. I asked myself that question, too. There's a group of eight of us that are out here from the Kansas Geological Survey, and we're measuring roughly 500 to 600 irrigation wells, mostly irrigation wells, to get some sense of what regional water levels are doing. We do this program along with the Division of Water Resources and the Department of Ag for the state of Kansas. And altogether, we'll measure hopefully about 1,400 wells over the next few weeks. We try to get out as close to the first of the year as we can. Most of these wells have been shut off for a while, so the water levels had a chance to stabilize. And also, we try to measure these wells at the same time every year, so you're getting consistent numbers. We go back to the same set of, hopefully, the same set of observation wells or wells that are part of the observation network that we have year after year after year. So most of the wells that we're measuring out here are wells we've measured before. We know something about their behavior, know what to expect when we come out here. And again, the idea is to come up with sort of a sense of what the regional water levels have done over the past year.
Rex Buchanan is director of the Kansas Geological Survey. He could be kicking back in a nice comfy chair in a heated office right now, but he's measuring water instead. How often do you do this, Rex? It sounds like once a year.
Yeah, some of these wells are in a quarterly measurement program, but this program that we're on is an annual program.
It is fairly obsessive, it sounds like, trying to hit the same time every year and all of that, go to all the same places. When I check things really obsessively, it's because I'm worried. So it's a cold January day and you're out measuring water in western Kansas. How worried are you about water in western Kansas?
Well, those are kind of two different questions. The first is, I would say, obviously, we don't look at it as being obsessive. We're just trying to get consistent data. And
fair
the
enough.
Longer period of time that you can come up with that data, the higher quality it is. So I would say maybe it is fair to say that we're somewhat obsessed about getting high-quality data so that the decisions people make, they can rely on the fact that the data behind them is good, and it's done every year in the same place at the same time, same way. So in that sense, maybe we are a little obsessive about
it.
But
for science.
Easier to wait. Yeah. Now, your other part of your question is a little bit bigger and a little different question. Now, in my role at the survey, our job is not to make policy. It's to provide information for the people that make decisions. And really, that's what we're doing out here today, is to come up with that data so the people in charge of making decisions can do that. Having said that, I don't think there's any question this is a huge natural resource issue for this state. In the long term, I think it's the most important natural resource issue that's facing the state of Kansas. So this is a big deal, no question about it.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard. Today's show is all about water, or possibly the lack thereof, in western Kansas. I want to get right back to Rex, who has kindly called us from a field somewhere, but let me quickly introduce the other guests who will be chiming in shortly. Frank Morris, KCUR's national correspondent and senior editor. Good morning.
Hi, Gina.
Frank, what would you say is at stake in a conversation about water in western Kansas? What's hanging in the balance?
Oh, geez. Gina, you know, that, I think it depends on your point of view. I mean, this is a pretty arid region that has a water-dependent economy. As Rex once told me, you know, you've got meatpacking that depends on cattle feeding that depends on corn that depends on water. You've got ethanol production that depends on corn that depends on water. Without you take away the water, which mostly comes out of the ground, mined as a resource that doesn't replenish itself very well. It replenishes itself very slowly. Most of the places where that aquifer is, you've got the end of a way of life, and you've got the end of an economic system that supports a certain amount of people living there. So if you're from Western Kansas, if that's your perspective, this is not only your livelihood, it's like the way of life that you had, that your parents had, that you want your kids to have. That's all hanging in the balance. If you're from Kansas City, it looks a little different. I mean, you know, I don't the value of that land definitely goes down. The value of all the enterprises out in Western Kansas that are dependent on the aquifer, that diminishes quite a bit. What that does to the state tax base, I'm not sure. But I think it's more of an economic perspective from here, much more of an emotional and really close to the bone kind of issue out in West.
We're also joined by Mark Rude, Executive Director of Southwest Kansas Groundwater Management District Number 3. He's calling us from Arizona. And Mark, what are you doing in Arizona?
Morning, Gina.
Hi.
Out in Arizona, we're visiting the Central Arizona Project. We're actually hosting a conference of Groundwater Management District Association, which is a national organization of groundwater management districts. And of course, the strength of that is that collaboration and communication on not only groundwater issues nationally, but back home in the neighborhood and how similar issues are being addressed in various places across the nation. And so this conference here is really to focus on the unique aspects of the Central Arizona Project and some of the other issues in the western U.S., like some major legislation out of California now mandating long-term sustainability in their groundwater basins. So a lot to talk about, and we're out here to learn.
Well, I want to get back to that in a minute, particularly the Central Arizona Project. But for now, Rex Buchanan, how are the water measurements you've been taking? How do they compare with previous measurements and with what you'd like to see?
Before I answer that, I'm trying to figure out why I'm in Mark's groundwater district in Arizona. There's something wrong with this picture, Mark. I'll bet it's warmer where you are.
Yes, it is.
The numbers, it's a little bit hard to say yet what these numbers tell us because we're finishing up our part of the measurement today. But, you know, sort of until we go through and analyze this stuff, I'd be a little reluctant to make any kind of sweeping generalizations. I will say that I think just anecdotally, as we've gotten together each night and compared numbers, we're not seeing some of the huge declines in the wells that we saw the previous 2 years, and that sort of fits with what we would have expected because it was so dry the previous two summers. We were seeing some pretty dramatic declines in some of the wells, especially in southwestern Kansas. Now, there's still some of those wells and some of those hot spots where we saw some pretty significant declines this week, but I would guess by the time Brownie Wilson's our data manager, by the time Brownie massages all these numbers, that the average decline, say in southwestern Kansas, there'll still will be a decline, but it won't be as significant as it was for the past couple of years.
Explain for our listeners what an aquifer is, because the Ogallala Aquifer is literally and figuratively underneath all of this.
Yeah, it's just basically an aquifer is basically a water-saturated rock formation, and it can produce water through a well. And the Ogallala is famous because it's so big. It underlies all parts of eight states. It's highly saturated with very high-quality water. It's a sand and gravel aquifer, most of sand and gravel that eroded off the face of the Rocky Mountains out onto the high plains. So the size of that pore space allows that water to be removed relatively quickly and easily. Don't think of it, and you use the word reservoir, and that's an okay word, but don't think of this as an underground lake because you couldn't send somebody down in scuba gear and float around down there. It's basically more like a water-saturated sponge instead of the sponge of sand and gravel.
Huh. Okay. So, and how quickly is it being depleted compared with how long it took it to get filled up?
Well, yeah, there really isn't any comparison. It's taken thousands of years for this water to accumulate. When Frank was talking about low recharge rates, he was right. Natural movement of the water back into the aquifer out here, or recharge as we call it, is maybe a half an inch to an inch per year because it's just so dry out here. And the water's being removed at the rate of feet per year, so it's being removed far more quickly than it accumulates. But in terms of it took thousands of years to get where we are, the water has been taken out, like I said, in Mark's district down where I am. Average decline, I think, last year when we were out here was maybe 4 feet. So when you're putting it back in, or when it's going back in at a half an inch a year and it's coming out at 36 or 48 or more inches per year, you can see that that's not just not sustainable. It's almost non-renewable when you think about it that way.
What is it that's taking the water out? Is it strictly irrigation, or are there other factors to consider?
Well, there's more uses for water than just irrigation, no question about that. I mean, people use it for domestic purposes. Manufacturing out here uses it. It gets used directly in agriculture. There are a lot of dairy farms down here in Mark's district that you see, a lot of pig farms, and those use water directly. But there's no question that the big, big bulk of the water is used for irrigation. Maybe, I don't know, Mark can give you that number better than I can, but I think 80 or 85% wouldn't be too far off.
Mark, do you know the number?
Well, it's really closer to about 93-94%. It's pretty high percentage in irrigation.
So, Rex, what do you think of the recently revived proposal to build an aqueduct to transport runoff from the Missouri River uphill to Kansas?
I think it's an interesting idea and probably worth some conversation and discussion. Mark can talk about it a lot more effectively than I can. I would say it's a sign of the level of concern that folks have out here for how it shows you how important they think water is. If they're willing to look at it, I'm sorry, my computer's mad that I'm sitting here so long.
Your computer in the field. We'll be done with you soon.
Okay. I think it is significant in the sense that it tells you how people out here are thinking and how they're trying to approach this issue.
What's your relationship with farming in western Kansas? Where does your interest come from?
Well, I grew up actually in central Kansas on a farm, and it was a non-irrigated farm, just wheat and cattle, and I still own ground out there. So I still, that part of how the state of Kansas operates still very close to my heart. Part of the reason I do come out here and help measure water levels with the other folks is this is just a world that I, in spite of growing up on a farm, this is a different kind of farming. This is large-scale irrigated farming that's very different than what I grew up with. And every time I come out here, I get exposed to something I've never seen before, and it helps me maybe understand what people out here are going through, what their different approaches are, how irrigation has changed over the years. I'll tell you what, it's an education to come out here and look at a farming at the scale that folks out in this part of the world do it.
Is the water situation a game changer for the future of farming in our region?
It is. It is in some senses, and Frank sort of touched on that when he was talking. These wells are not going to dry up overnight. Water, people are not going to, for the most part, turn on their taps in the morning and have nothing come out. This is a gradual process, and people begin to adjust their use of water. So I think that where you see people that see declines and maybe can't pump as much water as they used to, which certainly happens, you see some behavioral changes. They use less water. They may only use it, say, at the beginning of a growing period as opposed to the entire growing season. They may plant different crops. You hear a lot more about drought-tolerant corn or milo or sorghum out here. If worse comes worse, they may eventually go back to dry land farming, but I don't think you're going to see this wholesale abandonment of the land to turn it back to pasture. It's going to be sort of a gradual soft landing and changes of behavioral patterns as people adjust. And you already see that in parts of western Kansas.
Thanks so much, Rex.
Can I go back to work?
Yeah, you better.
Okay. Yeah, I'll turn you over to Frank and Mark. I'm sure you're in good hands. So
I'm sure, too.
Thanks for talking to me, and I'll go measure a well then.
Thanks. Stay warm. That was Rex Buchanan, director of the Kansas Geological Survey, calling us from a Kansas cornfield where he's measuring water right now. Frank Morris, national correspondent and senior editor here at KCUR. You've reported on these issues for a while now, and you've met a lot of farmers. Mm-hmm. Do they say any of the same things you hear Rex saying, or does their perspective tend to differ?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that I don't think that people are blind to the idea that these aquifers are kind of problematic and they're a long-term problem. Farmers have grown to depend on these. It's just their business model. Now, if you're over an aquifer and you can pump lots of water, you can make a lot more money than if you're not over an aquifer and you don't have water on your land. And so people will pump those aquifers, and if they don't do it, their neighbor will. And because, as you know, people say, it's not like there's a bathtub down there that follows your property lines. So, I mean, I think that in a sense, there's this. This is very broadly speaking, but there's a sense that yes, this is an issue. It's on the horizon, but at the same time, if my neighbor's not going to stop pumping, then why should I? Because you know, if he's just going to take the water that is going to seep away from my land if I don't use it.
So what else do we need to understand about how farmers see this playing out, how it affects them both personally and professionally?
That's a good question. I mean, Mark's a lot closer to this. I mean, you know, in Mark's district, the useful aquifer has retreated quite a bit. Isn't that right, Mark? I mean, there are places that used to be viable for irrigation in your district that aren't anymore. And so you've seen this transition, right?
Frank, that's right. There are some areas where maybe the aquifer was a little higher, a little thinner, but very prolific from the standpoint of conveying that water, as Rex had described earlier. And so water rights, the right to use the water, were developed early on. But as that water declined, then if you're high and thin, so to speak, in that aquifer, you ran out of water sooner. And so there are areas that are now dry land that used to be fully irrigated. There are other areas. We've got, of course, Frank, where there's hundreds of years yet of supply projected. So it varies significantly.
Right, right. But, I mean, you're kind of on the leading edge in your district of what a transition looks like, at least on a sort of farm-by-farm scale in western Kansas.
Yeah, Frank, you described it very well, and Rex alluded to this as well. It's a, farmers just, they look around at what Mother Nature hands them, what their opportunities are, the quality of the soil, the fertility. All of those factor into their decisions. And so they have to make their best choices based on a lot of factors, including water.
Hold that thought. Central Standard is headed off to a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear more from Mark Rood, a Kansas groundwater management guy who is out learning from the example of Arizona. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away.
That thing, you know, had a lot of water in it. It never went down, never changed it. But as you can see now, I can't believe I can't even see the water from up here. But.
And what do you blame it on?
Irrigation. Pumping the aquifer dry.
Right now, we're running right at 1,000 gallons a minute, 24/7.
That's Jesse Garrettson, standing by one of his irrigation wells near Copeland, Kansas. This one, and about 39,000 others like it in Kansas, pump long and hard in growing season. If you want a visual for that much water, picture Niagara Falls.
This is the actual roar of Niagara Falls.
In 2011, Kansas wells sucked out enough water to keep Niagara Falls thundering full force for 3 weeks. That's right, 3 weeks.
That's Frank Morris reporting on drought conditions in western Kansas in the summer of 2013. Whether we're still in a drought depends on who you ask, believe it or not, but whether Kansas has a water problem, generally speaking, is a little more conclusive. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking about what the water situation means for the future of farming in western Kansas. Frank is with us in the studio, and we'll get to him shortly, but let's turn now to Mark Rood. He's the executive director of Southwest Kansas Groundwater Management District Number 3. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you, Gina?
Good. How are you?
Very well. It's a good day to talk water.
Well, where is District Number 3?
Groundwater Management District Number 3 is in Southwest Kansas, covering all or part of 12 counties there in the southwest corner of Kansas.
But where are you now?
Well, right now I am in a radio studio here in Phoenix, Arizona, and so I'm here attending a conference, and we're learning about the Central Arizona Project.
Tell us what that is.
Well, CAP, or Central Arizona Project, is a project that was initiated. The discussions I think began back in the 20s, even, but. A number of years ago, they've been operating for more than 25 years, supplying 1.5 million acre feet of water annually from the Colorado River all across Arizona.
So, and, is this a model for the aqueduct proposal that's kind of resurfaced here?
Yeah, it is. In scope and in size, it's very similar to. One of the water transfer projects that resulted from the High Plains study in 1982, the Congress charged the Department of Commerce to take a look at this issue. Even in the 70s, it was noted that the High Plains Aquifer or the Ogallala Aquifer is declining in central U.S., and that has ramifications for national food security, agriculture, and basically U.S. commerce and exports. So,
what are the ramifications for food security?
Well, being able to, it's a basic model. If you import more food than you grow at home, then you become more reliant on other people to feed you. So
there's a question of whether we can continue feeding ourselves.
Well, yeah, the High Plains factors into that significantly. When you look at the, first of all, agriculture, we just continue to make breakthroughs and get better and better at that job. But irrigated agriculture is an assurance of a crop. And so as we get more and more efficient at growing crops and producing food as a nation, and in fact globally, that it mandates irrigation. Otherwise, you don't have the assurance of that crop.
As you hear it, it sounds like one option is finding methods of farming that rely on using less water. And then on the other hand, there's this aqueduct proposal where you find more water by pulling it into the state from somewhere else, in this case, runoff from the Missouri River. It sounds like you're explaining why people are interested in preserving the irrigation model.
That's exactly right. Gina, you know, if we can farm with what Mother Nature and the natural conditions give us, and of course we get better at trying to find ways to control those variables in nature, and that gets us more efficient and effective at what we're trying to do. Agriculture is right in the middle of that, whether it's trying to develop better genetics, ways with dealing with natural pests, or just the assurance of a crop that the soil fertility is correct and everything is optimal for whatever that crop is we're trying to grow, or what animal we're trying to feed. So water is a key element of that, and that's primarily why irrigation exists even where it rains. In Kansas it's an interesting setup because we sort of straddle that 100th meridian where and that's sort of the discussional dividing line in the U.S. between where water comes from the sky and where it only once in a while comes from the sky, but comes from other sources. It's dry to the west and it's wet to the east. And So generally in the eastern U.S., water becomes a liability, in some cases a negative value from the standpoint of flood damage, whereas in the west, rarely does that occur, and it's more of an equity in a resource in trying to accomplish our goals as a people and a nation.
You mentioned, like, if we can control nature, that's sort of the goal here. And I hate to get philosophical on you, but I'm going to. In the whole history of literature, you know, you read, it's like a recurring theme, man versus nature. And man trying to control nature typically loses. I wonder what your thoughts are. I mean, that's literature, not necessarily reality, but every time, is there an end to this game of trying to trump nature?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily couch it that way, and maybe I didn't select the best word. But I don't know that we ever control nature so much as learn about it, learn from it, and then act accordingly. You know, if we learn about some things in the natural world that we say, hey, you know what, if we actually water this plant, it will flourish. Well, then we want to put water to it. That's not controlling nature. That's just observing that when it rains on a plant, the plant responds. And then there's a whole plethora of variables that come into play there. So it's not, I don't view it so much as controlling nature as simply learning from nature and, you know, and then responding in an educated way to meet the goals that we have. So even when you jump now out to this aqueduct concept, you're simply recognizing that there's a lot of water in one place and there's a real need for water in another place. And more specifically, you've got advantages in that other place, like western Kansas, where it doesn't rain so much. And so some of the agricultural activities that tend to produce variables like nutrient runoff. You know, one of the strengths of western Kansas, as bizarre as it sounds, is that it doesn't rain a lot.
Why is that a strength?
Because from the standpoint of nutrient management, if you have, say, a lot of cattle or a lot of animal agriculture, or even you're concerned about maybe overapplying chemicals or fertilizers, where it rains a lot, that hydrologic cycle is very active, and you can run the risk of running those nutrients into the rivers and streams, and that's pollution. Well, if you can conduct the programs and the activities that you want to conduct in an area where it doesn't rain, you now have learned from nature and not so much controlling as simply responding to that risk. So if we want to have certain activities that have a polluting risk, well, then maybe you need to think about doing them where it doesn't rain so much.
Let's get Frank Morris responding to this. I want to hear if Frank has some questions for you.
Well, Mark, when I heard about this aqueduct proposal, I missed it in the 80s, and then when it surfaced again a few years ago, and I think you were kind of driving that, it really seemed like a sort of a desperation move. I'd ask you, for one thing, you know, what's in it for the other states? Is there really a flood control component to this? Because I don't know how you take water out of the Missouri River in any kind of quantity enough to reduce flooding. And that's, you know, it's sort of casual. Well, there's too much water in that river. Let's take some out. But if you're going to pump it uphill, I don't see how you can do that fast enough to, avert flooding downstream.
Yeah. Well, Frank, you've identified one of the vast number of issues that are out there. Mm. But going with that question on can you mitigate floods with an aqueduct? Well, marginally. I mean, I think the short answer is yes, you can. But is it a significant benefit to try to capture or harvest flood flows to the extent that it now significantly or in a material way reduces damages downstream? Well, that's doubtful, frankly. If you look at the flood of the Missouri River in 2012, 2011, if we would have grabbed say 10,000 cubic feet per second of that flow there going past Kansas City, it probably would be a negligible effect in that water level.
Yeah.
It was so much water. So vast was the water. So, yeah, from that standpoint, it's probably a benefit, but it's probably a small one.
So then you got the other problems with the Corps is backed up on flood control projects. Flood control is kind of the Corps' main focus on that Missouri River Basin. There's a lot of flood control activity.
That's the Army Corps of Engineers.
Army Corps of Engineers. How do you get as you say, Mark, there are lots and lots of political issues with, you know, tribal issues in terms of, you know, land issues. You've got states downstream. You've got states upstream that all fight like crazy over that Missouri River. It's not just out there, you know, low-hanging fruit. It's pretty contested as it is. And then you've got all the money. Something I read... the new figure might be something like $23-26 billion to build this.
Those are some estimates out there based on construction indexes updating the 82 study. But yeah, $25 billion. That's a lot of dollars.
Yeah, that's close to 2 years budget, total budget for the state of Kansas. And then, you know, you've got the time. By the time this thing got built, I wonder if agriculture wouldn't have already adjusted to a dry model. And you know, those water dependent businesses like ethanol and growing corn wouldn't already have shifted away.
Well, shifted away to where?
To you know, wheat. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, pretty soon or within the next few years, you're going to have another push to make drought-resistant wheat, genetically modified drought-resistant wheat. You have drought-resistant sorghum. You have things that you can grow out there and make money. It seems like in the time it would take to build that enormous project, you'd have other infill using that land productively.
Mark,
now, you know, Frank.
Mark, I'm gonna let you answer that in just a second, but I want to back up a second and have Frank. Can you explain and spell out some of this, the relationship between irrigation water and the particular kind of farming that we do in Western Kansas, and what some of the other? Because one of the options people recommend is shifting the kind of farming, as you're saying, but maybe spell that out a little more.
When I was growing up, I had a great uncle who had a farm out in near Tribune in Greeley County, a very dry farm. And so he did dryland wheat farming, which meant that he only got a crop every couple of years. You let the land recharge for a year and you plant it. So what happens now if you have irrigation is that you can grow corn, which is a lucrative crop. But these fields turn into 8-10 foot tall walls. They're basically largely made of water, you know, and so corn is pretty hard, pretty very hit or miss out in Western Kansas if you don't have irrigation. So you have to shift to a less water intensive, tougher crop like wheat. And I think that, you know, that's what people used to grow out there when they broke the soil was wheat. You know, before that, it was pasture. So those are the kind of options. However, with the genetics that are coming along, you have more options than just wheat. Or, you know, once you and also better tilling techniques where you're not disrupting the soil so much when you till it and losing soil, losing moisture. So that's the basic sort of shift. I'm not by no means claim to be any kind of expert on that, but that's the basic idea.
Well,
you move to a less lucrative but also less resource-intensive kind of farming.
Let's get Mark's response then to this question of by the time you could afford to build and solve the problems that you'd have to resolve in order to build an aqueduct that would pump water from the Missouri River to Kansas for farming, for irrigation, Frank's question is, wouldn't by that point farming have already had to make some sort of shift at the rate that the aquifer is being depleted?
Well, you know, it's speculation if to what extent the shift would be sort of helpful, beneficial. You like to use the word lucrative, basically profitable. Families and farms and communities just need to have endeavors locally that are profitable, or their local economy goes away. And you know, it's helpful to look backwards as we look forwards, but certainly the old family farm of my grandfather south of Wichita, where he made a living, albeit humble, on 240 acres. There's just no way for a family to do that nowadays. And it has to do with what we're willing to pay for food nationally, and a lot of other factors that have to do with profitability and yield. And, you know, you can allow a shift, as is happening today, as the aquifer depletes and lands and farms shift to dryland production. Their profitability greatly diminishes, their land values greatly diminish, and certainly the end will occur. And so the costs to the local economies, state economy, and nationally, of this high plains sort of drying up are going to be vast and tremendous. We'll be able to adjust somewhat with our techniques and our tillage practices, our soil management, to be able to do a better job than we ever did before with dryland farming, but it still won't even hold a candle to the kind of production that occurs under irrigation.
I guess.
And so irrigation will occur. It's just a matter of where in the world, and to meet the demands of this additional 2 billion people in the next 30 years.
Right. I guess it's just a matter of who pays for the $25 billion aqueduct that props up a certain kind of farming in western Kansas.
Sure. That's one of the key questions, and that's why you have to have the conversation, is what are you losing as a people, as a set of communities, as a state, in not building such an aqueduct, and then what would it cost? And then you have to examine those things and decide, does this make sense or not?
Mark, there's something that keeps happening that I've noticed, which is that there's the issue of what we need as a society and what we want as people, and then the question of what is possible. And it's easy to start answering questions about what is possible with what we want and what we need as a society. But scientifically, I mean, can you kind of tease that out a little bit? How does what we want and what we need as people, either economically or emotionally, play into our discussions of what is possible and what course of action we're going to take?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, we can be philosophical, and that is important, but we also have to be practical. And somewhere there has to be jobs and people's ability to feed themselves and pay their bills today and tomorrow, or 2 years from now. And then as we look ahead, we have to be cognizant, either as a family or as a community, you know, how are we doing? Can we support our schools? Can we you know, have the kind of environment we want? And that takes a practical, market-based viewpoint.
Mark Rood, Executive Director of Southwest Kansas Groundwater Management District No. 3, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Central Standard has to take one more quick break. In a minute, we'll talk to a guy who drills wells in Kansas. We'll hear what he has to say about all of this. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with KCUR's Frank Morris, talking about water and the future of farming in western Kansas. Now let's get Reuben Bartel on the line. He's with us from Well Drilling Incorporated and Southwest Windmill and Water Well. Hi, Reuben.
Hi.
How long have you been in the well business?
Well, pretty much all my life. My dad started the business in 1944, and I was born in 1955, so And when I graduated from college, I worked full-time, but before that, I worked part-time whenever I was out of school. And
what year are we talking about?
I graduated from college in 77, so.
How has your perception of water changed in the time you've been doing this since the 70s? How has your outlook changed? Has it?
Yes, it has drastically. Because in the middle 70s, I had a farmer ask me if we'd ever run out of water, and I said, no, we wouldn't. But that's when the irrigation started, and now drilling a well is more of a challenge because the water level has gone down so much that you can't just drill a well anywhere and get water. You've got to go to the right spot.
How do you find the right spot?
Well, I do some water witching, that's a whole other subject in itself.
Can you give us the short version?
Okay. Yeah, I use metal rods, L-shaped, and it'll put me on a stream of water, and that way we know we've had pretty good luck with that, getting to the right locations, because now, well, like I told the guy yesterday, around Plains, Kansas, which is 15 miles from Meade, the water table in the 70s used to be 146, and last year we had to lower a pump. We had to lower it down to 280 feet because the water level was around 260. So
wow.
In the 50 years, it's dropped about 100 feet.
So how do you feel about the future? What would you say is the prognosis for Kansas and for you?
Well, if nothing changes, the worst case scenario that there won't be any irrigation water at all left if they don't change anything, because there's not that much more water they can take out.
What are the options for you? I mean, that's your livelihood.
Yes, it is. It's, well, when all the wells are down to the bedrock, and about all you can do then is service the wells. Because right now we're really busy because so many people are out of water with the water table dropping the way it is.
So they're asking for new wells to find new sources of water.
Yes. Some of the wells haven't been drilled deep enough, and now we're having to go down to the bottom of the aquifer.
What do you think about this aqueduct idea, the idea of getting water from Missouri into Kansas? Do you think that's a viable solution?
Well, I'm not going to be politically correct in this answer, but I think it's stupid.
Explain that.
Because, well, you know, I was listening to Mark earlier, and he was talking about the flood, diverting the floodwaters from Missouri. And if you're going to recharge the Ogallala with the water from the Missouri, you'll have to do some kind of treatment to make sure it's clean water when you go down into the aquifer, because you don't want to just take raw water and run it down, because then there's a lot of pollution, chances for pollution.
I'm going to let Frank Morris jump in here. Frank, how do you respond to what we're hearing?
Oh, well, Ruben, by the way, this is Frank, I'm a radio reporter. I was out talking with you two and a half years ago. I spoke with you in your shop in Meade. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
It sounds like you were busy then. You're still busy. This well drilling had been. I'm surprised it's still going on full tilt out there.
Yeah, that all the drillers here are really busy, and they're backed up a couple of months in their work, mainly because the water table's been dropping and homes are having to go deeper for water.
You don't have to drill, though, to see that the aquifer's dropped. And we were talking before about the stream flow out in your part of Kansas, in southwest Kansas.
Yeah, well, there really isn't any stream flow out here. That's all gone.
So, but people are still requesting your services for more wells.
Yes.
And do you think at some point you will stop? Do you ever consider not honoring that request, or do you always do your best to find something that's going to work for your client, for your customer?
Well, we don't deal any with the irrigation wells. We just do domestic for like household water. That's all we'll do. And I think as far as that goes, there will always be household water, but to get the volume for irrigation, that's dropping drastically.
To tell us a little bit just about the difference between a household well and an irrigation well in terms of volume. I mean, it's pretty massive difference.
Yes, there is. Like a household well, you're looking like 10 to 20 gallon a minute of water. And for an irrigation well, the minimum that will work under a sprinkler is around the 300 gallons. Once you get below that, you're really not working very efficiently.
300 to 1,000 gallons a minute.
Right. And the average sprinkler needs about 700 gallons a minute to work.
And
that's the average.
Well, that's a lot of water.
That is a lot of water. Thanks so much for talking to us, Ruben.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Have a good one, Ruben.
Thank you.
Frank Morris of KCUR, does it scare you that the guy who drills wells for water is worried about the future of his business?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't scare me. I mean, I think this is something that's pretty widely understood in Western Kansas. You know, that aquifer, you know, as Mark said, it's got its thick places and it's got its thin places, and more of the aquifer is becoming unusable for irrigation.
Kevin tweeted us asking about the Buffalo Commons. What are they and what's the idea there?
That's another idea from the 70s, just like this aqueduct. And basically, it's, you know, the big idea is that you really never should have tilled that land out there in the first place. That's why there was a dust bowl, that land is much better suited for grazing. So if you go and that, you know, if you look at the population, except where there are meat packing and things like that out in western Kansas, population's been declining for 50 to 100 years in a lot of these counties. And the idea is that the Great Plains is going to open up again in the middle of the country, and you're going to see a lot less populated area. That's sort of the natural way things are going. That all the economic headwinds and you know, the ecology out there sort of point to more of that sort of a system, sort of like the sand hills in western Nebraska.
Let's talk very quickly with Matt in Baldwin City, Kansas. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What do you have to ask us today?
Well, Frank said something a little while back that just kind of struck a chord with me about how a stand of corn is essentially made of water. And I thought that was an interesting image. And it caused me to say, hey, wait a minute, that stand of corn is actually somebody's product, is a part of a business. And is not the aquifer sort of a public commons in a sense? And I can understand pumping the aquifer for your local water utility where everybody's paying for it. Are the farmers paying to pump the aquifer?
It's got to do with a lot of water law first in use principle, where you start using it, you develop a water right. And it's complicated, Matt, but they don't have to pay to pump the aquifer, but the aquifer is kind of considered a public resource that is governed. There are limits to how much you can pump the aquifer.
What about this idea of this being sort of a place where there's a convergence of a public good and a private good, in a way?
A convergence?
Well, where there's this issue of an industry and commerce, mm-hmm. and individuals making decisions about their own business model, and
right.
then a public resource.
But, well, they're linked, though. I mean, the public resource is getting used to make money, which then goes into those economies that, except for that resource, would probably go. If you go out to western Kansas, you see a lot of dead little towns and very decaying, dying little towns. Without the aquifer and all the money that corn brings into the system, a lot more of those towns would just go away.
What are the big questions you have just in sort of bullet point form looking ahead?
Well, I mean, I guess you wonder if there's a big transition happening out there. You wonder how smoothly it's going to happen, what kind of crops are going to be available, what it's going to do to the meatpacking industry and all the cattle, the pigs, the dairy cows out there. You wonder what Western Kansas is going to look like in 50 years. You know it's going to look different. But how it turns out is really something that's going to be needed to be managed pretty carefully, or else it could be kind of ugly.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Frank Morris, thanks so much for joining me in the studio this morning.
Happy to be here, Gina.
And thanks to everyone else who participated in today's show, including the fine folks at the studios of KJZZ in Arizona, who brought us Mark Rood. To listen back to this conversation, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about race in Kansas City's LGBTQ community. Don't miss that discussion tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton with lots of help from Patrick Quick. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.